If you'll be dressing up a tiny ghost or goblin to trick-or-treat tonight, you will be faced with a problem later. A glut of candy, typically dumped on the living room floor or tucked away in a pillowcase. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on one possible solution to that problem, compliments of America's dentists.
Halloween is supposed to be scary.
They're fine.
They're near. They're gone.
And mysterious, the night of the wandering dead. But for most kids, this is what it's really about.
Say trick or treat.
It's about the candy. Lots of us remember digging through our little plastic jack-o'-lanterns and gorging on Halloween night. I would trade anything to get my hands on more Almond Joys. But the problem, as Chris Kammer, a dentist in Wisconsin, sees it, is that for lots of kids, the candy gorging can go on for weeks.
If you think about it, a young child sitting with a shopping bag full of candy, they eat some of their favorites, then they start eating the things they don't even like just because it's there. The thought of that just makes me shudder.
So several years back, he had an idea. What if his dental practice offered to buy back Halloween candy from his young patients? Think of it as cash for candy. Kammer says he ran the concept by his own children.
When I first started telling my kids that, yeah, here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy kids candy back for $1 a pound. And they looked at me and they said, Dad, that's a terrible idea.
But Kammer decided to go ahead with it anyway. And to his surprise, he was not seen as the Halloween Grinch. It was a hit. Kids got some candy on Halloween night, and families were happy to drop off their excess at his dental office.
The first year we had done it, there was so much excitement about it. I mean, they were talking about it all over the state of Wisconsin. And then it was at that time I decided, wow, this could be the national response to Halloween.
There are now nearly 3,000 dentists signed up for the Halloween candy buyback program. And what do they do with all of this candy?
The dentists send the candy to us at Operation Gratitude here in Southern California, and then we include it in our care packages that we send to U.S. military who are deployed overseas.
That's Carolyn Blaschek, the founder of Operation Gratitude, which has sent over 1 million care packages filled with things like DVDs, games, and personal grooming products to U.S. troops. She says adding the Halloween candy is a nice compliment.
Well, it's a great morale boost for the troops. It reminds them of home. It reminds them of the great traditions that we celebrate here. But most importantly to me, this provides an opportunity for every American child to say thank you to the military.
Last year, Blaschek collected about 250,000 pounds of candy to share. But with so many new dentists signed up,
we expect to get a whole lot more, probably about 300,000 pounds.
Wow, 300,000 pounds. What does that look like stacked up in a big room?
It's pretty extraordinary. It's many, many, many semi-truckloads full.
So in trying to save kids from eating too much sugar at Halloween, could we be promoting tooth decay in our troops by participating? Blaschek says, absolutely not.
We also send toothbrushes and toothpaste along with the candies.
And she says each service member gets only a few pieces. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
This time last year, students in Los Angeles watched boxes of new iPads roll into their schools. Touted as the largest technology expansion in the country, the program ran into a host of problems, leading to the resignation of its biggest advocate, Superintendent John Dacey. KPCC's Annie Gilbertson reports on what's next.
Dacey told NPR he doesn't want Los Angeles Unified's iPad program to leave with him.
If it's dead, we're doomed.
But its future is out of his hands. Top administrators are now rethinking classroom needs. Should they look at laptops instead of tablets? School board member Steve Zimmer says the technology expansion isn't over, but it will be different.
I think that we'll get there by looking at the technology needs of each school and figuring out a personalized package, if you will, for each school site.
Zimmer says it's time for a fresh start. Dacey had canceled the iPad contract in August under mounting scrutiny over the fairness of the bidding process. Only 15% of students got iPads. just as uncertain is the future of the educational software developed for the tablets by Pearson Publishing. Bernadette Lucas, head of LA Unified's initiative, says it's revolutionary.
Pearson is a doorway to a whole nother world for the kids around creativity, innovation, critical thinking, computational thinking, research.
Interactive lessons on tablets promise to engage students, and real-time feedback, if it works, should speed learning for those falling behind. But a recent survey of 15 LA schools with tablets found only one classroom used the Pearson app. Teacher Ben Way sees the software as more of a roadblock than a doorway. Way's students at Simon Tech Academy in South Los Angeles are mostly Latino, many from low-income homes, and are often behind in math.
So this is the grade 9 math, which is what I'm currently teaching.
Way fires up the Pearson app to show me how it works. The lesson begins with a short video showing cells dividing. Soon, the whole screen is filled with moving bacteria.
One cell divides into two, and then you have to count for two cells dividing into two, which is four.
Right.
Four cells dividing into two, which is eight.
How does it change each time?
Remember, this is a math class. Students have to represent this as a mathematical equation. But can they do it?
I get a lot of blank stares.
Way says the software should give students step-by-step examples and math problems to practice. But it doesn't.
You need to make up your own problems that are similar, and that sort of defeats the purpose of buying a curriculum.
Nevertheless, school leaders nationwide believe technology can transform classrooms. In fact, the bigger question is simply how to pay for it. Next week, voters in New York State will decide whether to buy $2 billion in bonds for school tech. School board member Monica Ratliff says L.A. was planning to use bond funds, too.
The reality is that we need a long-term plan in terms of how we're going to sustain this program. I haven't seen it yet.
The iPad for Every Student program would have cost more than $1.3 billion. Almost half of that, $500 million, would have gone for the tablets and the software. They've got the money now, but Ratliff wonders what happens with the next big bill that would come in a few years, when 650,000 devices would need to be replaced. For NPR News, I'm Annie Gilbertson in Los Angeles.
As you know, Steve and I share hosting duties here on Morning Edition with David Green. Not the former Georgia quarterback David Green, or TV director David Green, or Welsh hurdler David Green, but do a Google search for David Green and all those other folks will show up too. Sharing names has never been as obvious as it is today, with search engines and social media reminding us how unspecial we really are. NPR's Elise Hugh explores the difficulty of distinguishing yourself online when so many others go by the same name.
My name is Justin Dane. I'm a video journalist in Austin, Texas.
Justin Dane isn't the only Justin Dane, spelled D-E-H-N.
This is Justin.
No, wait a second. This is Justin.
What's up, dude?
How you doing, man?
After Justin Dane saw his own name on Facebook, but tied to an entirely different identity, Justin Dane friended the other Justin Dane, who's also in video production, but in Minneapolis.
And then I wrote you and I said, hey, I don't think we've ever met, but I'm assuming that you're adding me because we have the same name. And then we chatted a little bit of how we pronounced it.
Since then, they've dealt with their share of name-related mishaps.
I was getting emails from your girlfriend at the time, just like with just normal everyday notes like, hey, don't forget to take the trash out.
Or
I think I forwarded some to you like, don't forget to take the trash out.
Yeah, you did.
This kind of confusion caused by same nameness isn't new, but now it's easier than ever to find others with your name online. And with more all-digital communication, mix-ups matter more, too. Judith Donath is a researcher at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She says online names are everything.
One of the most important things online is the reputation you build up. It's really the entirety of your identity in a world where there is no body. And when you share your name with many other people, you start sharing effectively a history and reputation with them.
In 2005, writer Mike Sager wasn't keen to share his name with so many other Mike Sagers.
I need to use my name. I'm Mike Sager. I am Mike Sager.
But since he isn't the only one, Sager set out on a cross-country journey to meet the other Mike Sagers.
There was Lutheran pastor Mike Sager in Spokane. There was motorcycle racer sound technologist Mike Sager in Wenatchee, Washington. In all, I ended up getting in touch with 39 Mike Sagers and going to meet 11 Mike Sagers.
The road trip reminded him, we may all want to be distinct, but we can't deny we're linked.
It gives you a better view on how we're all related in different ways as humans and, you know, particularly by name, even if we don't know each other.
But what if you share a name with someone less than appealing, someone with a bad reputation?
We call that at Reputation.com, we call that the doppelnamer problem, obviously after the doppelganger problem, where you share the name with someone who's got a bad rep or who's someone famous, who's just not you.
That's Michael Furtick, the founder and CEO of Reputation.com. The company is among NPR's supporters, and it helps users distinguish themselves in search results because nowadays, the vast majority of people you interact with will look you up online first.
So the whole idea is to fly your flag, first of all, if you don't have one, and secondly, so to fly your flag prominently and largely enough, grandly enough, that people can find the full picture of your body of work, of your life.
Donath, the Harvard researcher, thinks the digital future should be entirely less name-reliant to end the mix-ups and to better protect privacy. Until a change happens, the Mike Sager name is doing pretty well, at least for the writer, Mike Sager.
I'm just going to enter Mike Sager here. Mike Sager, journalist, author, comes up first of 32,700 results.
It's a little easier for him than others since he's a journalist. He signs all his work with his name. No one fixing a road gets to sign the road. But he hasn't forgotten about all the other Mike Sagers.
In life, that is the ultimate lesson, that all of us think we're the most important. You want life to go how you want it to for you and your name. You know, there's all these other people that feel the same way about themselves.
No one else is uniquely you, but you'll probably have to share your name. Elise Hu, NPR News.
The Metropolitan Opera will be celebrating New Year's Eve with Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow, one of the most beloved operettas ever written, in a new production starring soprano Renee Fleming. Later, it will be telecast in theaters worldwide. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz wonders whether any stage production could ever surpass the first two movie versions. Both films are now available on DVD.
I'm going to Maxim's, where all the girls have dreams. Each kiss goes on the wine list, and mine is quite a fine list.
Is she beautiful?
She owns 52% of Marsovia, so she is beautiful. If you like her or not, you love her. This is cold-blooded patriotism. Did you ever have diplomatic relations with a woman?
Viennese operetta was originally intended for the intimacy of live theater, but the greatest incarnations of Franz Lehár's beloved The Merry Widow, which premiered in 1905, have been on film. In 1934, Ernst Lubitsch directed a version starring Jeanette MacDonald and Maurice Chevalier, with English translations of the song lyrics by no less than Lawrence Hart of Rodgers and Hart. The film won an Oscar for art direction, but the whole look of the film is a manifestation of Lubitsch's masterly touch. Every detail is embedded with his sly sense of irony. It's a fantasy of black and white, with dazzling can-can girls, and one of the most breathtaking musical numbers ever filmed, an embassy ball with a narrow hall of mirrors endlessly multiplying the number of waltzing couples swirling through as if they were in a glorious and terrifying dream. Lubitsch's adaptation is tighter, sharper, sexier, and much funnier than the original operetta. In this movie, the king of the mythical country of Marsovia is afraid a wealthy young widow is going to destabilize the economy by taking her money out of the country. so he orders the irresistibly dashing Captain Danilo to marry her. Danilo has already tried to make love to her, even though he has never seen her face without a mask. Unsettled by Danilo and depressed by her widowhood, she's determined to cheer up. Suddenly, her entire wardrobe, even her pet Pekingese, turns miraculously from black to dazzling white, and the now merry widow heads for gay Paris. At the famously indecorous Maxime's, Danilo mistakes the widow for one of the bistro's bevy of beauties, all too eager for a one-night stand. Lubitsch gives their encounter a powerful, erotic charge. Complications ensue, both hilarious and surprisingly poignant.
I love you, Sonia.
So I noticed last night.
Oh, please. I'm mad about you.
Everybody is. I've heard it at least 100 times tonight. And everybody wants to marry me. There must be something wonderful about me. What is it that fascinates all these men? What can it be? Is it my charm? Or my beauty? Or, do you suppose it's my position?
You mean your money?
Yes.
I don't know about the other men, but with me, it's strictly your money and nothing else.
I believe you.
I knew you would. That's why I said it. If you had only told me last night who you were, if I had only known that I held in my arms the richest widow I... What did you come to Maxim's for anyway? Oh, I see. Just a rich woman looking for a thrill.
Goodbye, Captain.
Finally, the two are trapped into admitting they really love each other. An earlier silent version of The Merry Widow from 1925 has a completely different tone. Its director, Erich von Stroheim, was not known for lighthearted comedies. This silent Merry Widow, by necessity, concentrates on the story over the music. So von Stroheim invents a painful backstory about how the widow acquired her wealth. A chorus girl spurned by Danilo's royal family, she marries a wealthy old baron, a crippled foot fetishist, who dies on their wedding night. The villain is Danilo's nasty cousin, the crown prince, who nearly kills Danilo in a duel over the widow. And his assassination suggests that what's really behind the film's bitter irony is the First World War. It's fascinating how many different ways Lehar's delightful music has resurfaced over the years. In Alfred Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, Joseph Cotten plays the Merry Widow murderer, and the famous waltz in a minor key becomes disturbingly sinister. Shostakovich, in his grim 1940 Symphony No. 7, which depicts the siege of Leningrad, transforms I'm Going to Maxim's, Lehar's jolly anthem of Parisian decadence, into a relentless and menacing march. 3 years later, that same music turns up again in Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, where it seems to be an expression of satirical contempt for Shostakovich. So von Stroheim was prescient in his ability to see the chilling underside of Lehar's operetta. His very dark comedy and Lubitsch's brilliant musical, perhaps more than any traditional stage production, are what have really kept the whole operetta alive for me, each in its own way, revealing something profound lurking under the trivial surface.
Lloyd Schwartz is senior classical music editor of the online journal New York Arts and teaches in the Creative Writing MFA program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston.
She can't go to Maxine's. Not in my wildest dreams.
Her face must not be shown there.
And we are too well known there.
Lolo, Dodo, Juju, Clo-Clo, Margot, Frou-Frou, we promise to be faithful until the night is through.